My parents were missionaries. Their graves are in India. Grandparents were missionaries. My grandfather's grave is in India. All of my aunts and uncles, 7, were all missionaries. They were missionaries in Ethiopia, Trinidad, Sumatra, China, Japan, India, Kenya. Almost every major country my parents have been in, which makes it really easy for me to travel because I can pretty well go to any of these countries and find people that know my family and have a nice place to stay. But because of that, I've grown up with missions. I've had my whole life imbued with missions. And so therefore, a lot of this area is important to me because I've seen that there are many blockages that we have as missionaries and as evangelists and as Christians engaging with Islam. So I'm going to start with the blockages, and then we're going to end with the bridges, because the two, in some cases, they'll go hand in hand. So let's go ahead, and I'm going to talk about really 6 different areas of blockages. And the areas I'm going to cover are, five. Cultural blockages, political blockages, spiritual blockages, theological blockages, and missiological blockages. This paper is on that flash drive that we'll be sending you so you can get copies of it, like the one this morning. Remember that when we bridge, we are bridging to Muslims, not to Islam. Let me repeat that. When we bridge, we are bridging to Muslims. We do not bridge to Islam. Enormously important. And I think that has been some of the problem that we've had in missiology is that we have tended to assume that it is Islam that we want to bridge through. And that's the first one I'm going to talk about, and that's the cultural blockages. Culturally speaking, there has been this pervasive view, and especially here in America, not so much in Europe or other countries, that to be a Middle Easterner, to be somebody from the Arab world, you must be a Muslim. That Islam is so pervasive in these countries that you cannot really stand outside of your Muslim, as they say, Muslim culture. You cannot be in those countries without being a Muslim individual. And unfortunately, this has been really made popular by the insider movement that starts from that premise. The top problem with that whole ethos is most every one of these countries in the Middle East were Christian before they were Muslim, were they not? In fact, the church has been in those countries for 2,000 years. Islam has only been there for 1,400 years. And the way they dress, walk, and talk, the way they eat their food has been Christian long before it was Muslim. So Arab food was Christian before it was ever made Muslim. But yet we think of it as being Muslim. So therefore, the ethos is you must become a Muslim to be an Arab. Do any of you feel comfortable with that? And out of that thinking comes the idea that we share the same God, that Allah and Yahweh are the same God. As we saw this morning, if you want to claim that, you have all the right to do so, but I will not accept it for one very good reason. When I look at Allah, He's nothing like my Yahweh. And I want nothing to do with Allah. He's deceitful. He's punitive. He is absolutely egotistical. And more than that, He is incapable of coming to earth, incapable of walking and talking with His own creation, incapable of having a relationship with me. What kind of God would you want to follow? Not a God like that. This idea of the cultural baggage that comes with Islam, to me, if you start from that premise, you're actually acquiescing to Islam, and I would suggest that is something that Muslims would want you to believe, that to be a Middle Easterner is to be a Muslim. To me, that sounds more like their agenda than our agenda, because I think Christ is supraculture. Christ is above culture, but also Christian culture. The whole idea and ethos of Christianity has now been around for 2,000 years, that so much of what we are in the West is because of a Judeo-Christian mindset. And I see this especially when I look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which is considered to be the most universal document in the world today for dictating what morality is universally. There have been 126 nations that have signed up the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. It has 21 articles. Look at every one of those 21 articles, and you will see that every one of them is housed in the Bible. They come straight out of the New Testament. 8 of them Muslims cannot sign up to. 8 of them are rejected by the Quran. Proof to me that even the most universal document that is accepted by the majority of nations around the world is permeated by Christian thinking. To me, that's exciting. And that's why when I go to another culture, like an Islamic culture, and to hear people say that we must become Islamic to preach the gospel, I shake my head, because that's a blockage. That will cause all kinds of blockages, to say nothing of the fact that it starts from deceit, because no one, I don't know of anybody that actually believes what they're doing when they do that. This Arab identity, and this idea of having an Arab identity to minister to Muslims, to me is also anathema when you just look at the sheer numbers. Look at the number of Muslims in the world today. Let's just say, off the top of my head, 1.8 billion. That's what most Muslims tell me, 1.8 billion. Of the 1.8 billion, how many of them speak Arabic? 270 million. That's just 15%. 85% of Muslims do not speak Arabic. So if you say to be a Muslim you have to be an Arab, then I would suggest, what about the 85% who don't understand Arabic? And the vast majority of Muslims do not live in the Middle East. They live in Asia. Indonesia, 200 million. Pakistan, 200 million. India, supposed to now surpass 200 million, according to the latest statistics, it has now surpassed Pakistan as the second largest Muslim country on earth. You don't think of India as being a Muslim country, do you? You think it as being a Hindu country with 800 million Hindus. But all of northern India is Muslim. That's where I grew up. And that's why we need to look at these numbers. Bangladesh, 160 million Muslims. So if you just take Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh, which used to be one country before 1947, that was called India, just look at the Muslim population in those three countries, you get almost 600 million Muslims. No place in the world can brag that kind of those kinds of numbers. So this idea of taking on an Arab identity to be a Muslim, to work with Muslims, is anathema when you go to the Indian subcontinent. They do not take on Arab identities. They do not wear Arab dress. They don't even speak Arabic. They will use Arabic when they memorize the Quran, and they memorize their Quran without understanding a word of it. I had a friend in London whose name was Ishmael. He was from Pakistan, and he had memorized the entire Quran, and I would always love to play the Mickey on him, and I would say, okay, come on, Ishmael, tell me. Chapter 2, verse 147. Tell me what it says. And he thinks a little bit and then goes, tick, 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 gets word for word perfect. I said, what have you just said? He says, I have no idea. He has no idea what he just repeated to me. And I said, well, then what's the purpose of memorizing it? For him, there is no reason to memorize it, because to understand it, they memorize it to receive barakah, to receive blessing. Recorded by the angel that sits on their right shoulder. Every one of you is given an angel. One sits on your right shoulder, one sits on your left shoulder. This one records your bad deeds, this records your good deeds. And hopefully when you die, the records are taken off. That's right, he's there. You can't see him, don't hit him. He's trying to knock off his bad angel. Remember, he's recording everything you've just done. And so at death, the belief is at death, these two records are put on a scale, and hopefully your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds. And if they outweigh your bad deeds, then you're given the right to cross the Sirat bridge, the razor sharp bridge, over into paradise. As you're crossing the bridge, you can be thrown down to hell at any time, which means Muslims have no assurance of salvation. None. But you do. There's a bridge. What a bridge. Use that as a bridge. You've got an assurance of salvation. Start with that. Let them get jealous by it. I think it's terrific that we have something that they can't even begin to hope for. They can only hope for salvation. Not even Muhammad knew whether he's going to make it across that bridge. There is a Muslim bias. And when you go into the Muslim world, the more you go, you're there, and the longer you're there, the longer you're with Muslims, you will see that when they start talking and when they get into conversations with you, depending if they come from the Arab world or if they come from the Indian subcontinent, the conversations will not be the same. I have rarely got into a conversation with an Arab Muslim that is theological. Primarily because the Arab Muslims don't understand theology. They don't need to. They are not threatened by anybody, theologically speaking. Because Islam is so pervasive in the Middle East, the Christians are so small and weak, they are not a threat. Therefore, you will not find Arab speakers who love to debate. I can't find one debater anywhere in the world that's from the Arab world. Can any of you know of a good debater from the Muslim world that's Arab? No, I'm saying Arab Muslim. Father Zakariyyah is a Christian, thank God. And he decimates the Muslims because they don't know how to defend themselves. Father Zakariyyah is a Christian debater. But he doesn't debate. He just has television shows and he just destroys Muslims using their own material. Because there's nobody, really, Muslims have never had to debate. I don't know of any Muslims that had to debate theologically. When we talk with Muslims, almost invariably, whenever I get into a debate with an Arab Muslim, it's always to do with Israel. It's political. It's always to do with Iraq, Afghanistan. It's to do with Donald Trump or Obama. I never, ever get into a theological debate with them because they don't. To them, it's not important. They don't realize that there's a difficulty there. They don't even know anything about the Trinity. I've yet to see an Arab Muslim that really can define or attack me on the Trinity. But when I get into a debate with a Pakistani or a Bangladeshi or an Indian, just yesterday at the mosque we were at, I got into 10 different talks, and on every one of them, I don't know why, but I was blessed with every one of them were Pakistanis. Maybe that mosque has an overwhelming number of Pakistanis. I don't know, in Diamond Bar. But it was fascinating, and every one of them, we got theological. Every one of them, we started with the existence of God. Every one of them, we got onto the Trinity. Not every one of them. A lot of them, we got onto the Quran. They all wanted to talk about the Quran. Amazing. And that's why I take a deep breath whenever I have an Indian subcontinent. Anybody from Pakistan, India, or Bangladesh, take a deep breath. You're in for a great discussion. You're in for a great debate. And please debate them. They love debate. Indians, the whole Indian subcontinent, we have a whole tradition of debates. We call them munazaras. If you look at the munazaras from the 1800s and the 1700s, they were debates that went on for 15 days, not just 2 hours. We get exhausted after 2 hours. They go for 15 days. So their whole tradition is based on that. It's a beautiful bridge, and I find it's one of the best bridges we have. Because certainly a Pakistani, Indian, Bangladesh, they love to talk about theology. And they will use, are you from India? Pakistan, there you go. Am I not correct on this? You get into great theological debates with them. Growing up in India, we always take the railway to get back to our homes. And every time on the railway, I always go third class. I didn't like first or second class. I always liked third class because there you're amongst the people. And of course, having an American accent, they always wanted to destroy America because America is amalgamated with Pakistan. Russia is amalgamated with India. And so in India, I'm hated because I am the enemy. Because I am part of Pakistan, isn't that right? So you have a strong relationship with America. India's always had a strong relationship with Russia. So I had to defend America, and I never wanted to defend America. I just wanted to defend Jesus. And so we got into a theological discussion almost immediately, and we would just go at it. And after about 50 minutes, I had spittle all over my front. Because they don't just yell at you. They spit you at, not because they're so passionate. And then they always, always, always make sure we got some tea. And they'd always pay for it, and they always give me tea so we can go for the second round. It was so much fun. And that's why I learned how to debate, because of my Indian friends, my Muslims. They just love to debate. And I think that's something that we don't do, because we don't teach that in homiletics, do we? Is there any school here in California that teaches you how to debate theologically? You don't need to. There's no one that's debating you. The Pakistanis and Indians love it. And that's why we need to engage with it, learn how to do it, and use it. Now, there is another, let's go into the political blockages. One of the big problems we have is that those of us, especially in America, we like to bring Israel into our discussion. And if we don't bring it in, a lot of times the Muslims might introduce it. May I suggest you leave Israel at home? Please do. Please don't talk about Israel. Because once you introduce that, you'll never get off it. And the discussion will go for hours just on Israel. And you've wasted hours because you should be talking about Jesus Christ. Get off of Israel. Please don't bring it into your discussion. Please don't introduce it. Just talk about Jesus. He's the easiest to talk about anyways, and he's certainly the most exciting to talk about. And really, you're doing the gospel a favor. You're doing Jesus a favor if you just bring him into the discussion. Israel, you can talk about at home when you're with your family or with your friends, but not with Muslims. The other thing is leave your U.S. proclivities, your U.S. political viewpoints at home. If you're a Trump supporter, don't talk about Trump. If you hate Trump, don't hate Trump. Just love Jesus, okay? Please, 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 keep your politics at home. Muslims love to denigrate anything you say, and it gets you off the subject that's most important anyways. You can have plenty of time to talk about your politics. Now, unfortunately, it's on every newspaper and it's on every airwave at the moment because we're leading up to an election. All the more reason. The other thing is, be careful how you defend or even speak about the wars that America has been involved in, especially Afghanistan, Iraq. You will not find a Muslim that I have yet to find a Muslim that supports those two wars. So don't you support them. Just stop. Don't even talk about them. Because you're not going to do the gospel any favor if you try to defend what happened in Afghanistan or Iraq. Just keep to Jesus. And the easiest thing is, listen, I'm not here to defend what George Bush did or what anybody of my Obama did. I'm here to defend Jesus Christ. Not Obama, not Bush, not Trump. Spiritual blockages. Spiritual warfare. There seems to have been a blindness. Muslims, and I hear this from a lot of missionaries, as soon as they get into a gospel presentation, Muslims seem to become aggressive. Have you noticed this? And the aggression seems to be on one area especially. You will be talking about the Quran, and I do talk about the Quran quite a bit, and Muslims will get a little angry. I can pretty much hammer Allah, and they won't get too upset with Allah. But as soon as I touch Muhammad, as soon as I say anything about Muhammad, they go ballistic. There's something about Muhammad that is visceral to every Muslim that I met. And they have never met Muhammad. They don't even understand Muhammad. They have never looked at his biography. They don't look at his sayings that much, yet they absolutely love Muhammad. Why do they love Muhammad so much? And why do they go visceral? I think I've got the answer, and I think the reason why is because when you look at Muhammad, you realize what they do with Muhammad is what we already know about Jesus Christ. Have you noticed? We already know God personally. Every one of us has a relationship with Jesus Christ. And if you don't, make sure you do. Which means we have something they don't have. We have something they're all looking for. Everybody wants a relationship with God. Everybody wants to know God face to face. Everybody wants to be able to talk to God and have him respond to you. Islam doesn't give you any of that. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist. Allah is totally other, totally distant, has never entered time and space, has never come and walked and talked in the cool of the day. We've never been with Allah face to face. Adam and Eve were never with Allah face to face. Because of that, if God is totally other and totally distant, how can you get close to God? Well, who are you going to use as a replacement? Well, it's right there in the Quran. It's very clear. Over and over again, when you see the Shahada there, which is fascinating because the Shahada is never together in one place in the Quran. It's always La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah is then added at a later date. What's fascinating is the two that are put together in the Shahada today, and the first time we've seen that is on the Dome of the Rock in 691 as a historical precedence, because that means for 60 years, they never said the Shahada. That is introduced on the Dome of the Rock. We can't find any documentation earlier than that. What's fascinating, though, the fact that they've put Muhammad there alongside Allah suggests they've elevated Muhammad, have they not, to a status he cannot belong. What's he doing with God? Isn't that shirk? Haven't they elevated to a man to the status of God? If he's part of their statement of faith, then I would suggest that gives him divine status. They say we've done the same thing with Jesus Christ. Interestingly, you can throw that right back in their laps. There's a good bridge. But what's fascinating is when you look at that, when you ask about that, this Shahada, and you're going back to that, remind yourself that once you confront that man, expect a reaction. Remember when those cartoons came out, those 12 cartoons in Denmark, the Danish cartoons? The reaction that happened all over the world, riot after riot, 17 people lost their lives. I went down to Trafalgar Square in London, and they had a big rally for Islam there, and I went in, and I wanted to just talk to people. I wanted to see why the Muslims were reacting so viscerally against these 12 simple cartoons. Funny, but simple. And I kept on hearing the same refrain. You don't understand, Mr. Smith. Muhammad is closer to me than my father. He's closer to me than my brother. I said, what do you mean closer than your father? You've never seen Muhammad. He lived 1,400 years ago. How can you say he's closer to you? And I started to realize the penny dropped after about the fourth or fifth person that said this to me. I suddenly realized They are basically imposing on Muhammad what they see we have with Jesus Christ. They want what we've got. They want that same relationship with God that we already have. Everything we've got is what they want, which means everything they need we've already got. So why don't we give them Jesus? Forget about Muhammad. Can you see when you look and do a comparative between Jesus and Muhammad, just do a quick comparative and you can see immediately that there's nothing at all comparable. I did this when I was in Dearborn. I saw a man standing there with a sign, a Muslim, and he had Jesus and Muhammad. We love them both. So I went up to him and I said, you know, I'm so glad you got Jesus above Muhammad. Make sure you keep Jesus above Muhammad. Don't put him down there. And he says, no, they're the same. I said, no, they're not. Jesus is far superior to Muhammad, even in your Quran. Let me show you how. And so I started I had the Quran in my hand. You know, the Muslims never have a Quran in their hand. I have the Quran. You are to have Qurans. They never carry Qurans. They will carry Bibles with little post-it notes all the way through it with all these seeming errors and seeming contradictions. But they never have a Quran in their hands, which to me is anathema. If they love it so much, why don't they then hold on to it? So I always keep my Quran there, and I open my Quran. So I started with chapter 19, verse 20. And I said, let's do a comparison between Muhammad and Jesus in the Quran. I'm not going to go to the Bible. I'm going to start with the Quran. And I went to chapter 19, verse 20, which stipulates that Mary was a virgin when she conceived Jesus. So already you see there's something miraculous about his birth. So I asked my Muslim friend, his name was Abdul. I said, Abdul, was Muhammad born miraculously? He said, no, he was born quite normally. I said, well, then there's something different going on here. The fact that he was born of a virgin is absolutely significant. Do you know why he had to be born of a virgin? And he says, no, I don't know why. I said, well, what are you supposed to do when you don't know something? Who are you supposed to go to? In chapter 10:94 of the Quran, in chapter 21, verse 7 of the Quran, it says, if you have any question, go to the people of the book. That's us. Come back to us. I'll tell you the reason. The reason is because of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. You notice I'm keeping with 7:14 everywhere I go. It's so easy because 7 is the perfect number. Double that is 14, so you can memorize it that easy. It just so happens that's the right place you want to go to. Because there in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, the prophet Isaiah says, for this shall be a sign. Wake up, Muslims. This is a sign for you. A virgin will conceive, not just any woman, a virgin. Now, I know in my world, no virgins conceive. That is impossible for a virgin to conceive. If she does conceive, that means this must be a miracle. So this is a miracle. Listen to this miracle. A virgin will conceive and bear a son. That refers to Genesis 3:15, when God said to Eve, turning to Eve, he says, from your line, he will come. That means it must be a male. And it has to come from a woman's line, not from a man's line. It must be from a woman. Now Isaiah is saying who that woman is. She's going to be a virgin. That's why when the virgin conceives, read the rest of the verse, he shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. So when the virgin conceives, wake up, this is a miracle. When she conceives, that's God with us. God's now here. Ooh, it's a great bridge. I love that. So you've gone to 19, verse 20, showing that this is a unique birth. Muhammad has nothing like this. Then jump to chapter 3, verse 46, because chapter 3, verse 46, it says that this Issa, this Jesus, wrong name, but nonetheless, this Jesus, as a baby, speaks from the cradle. Could Muhammad speak from the cradle? Absolutely not. Three verses later, in verse 49, chapter 3, it says that this Jesus takes some mud, forms him into clay, blows on them, and they fly up into the air, creates out of nothing. Could Muhammad create anything? Absolutely not. And then it continues on and says that this Jesus, as a baby, he then gives sight to the blind, heals the lepers, and resuscitates the dead. Could Muhammad do any of those? Muhammad never did a miracle. He was asked three times by the Jews to do a miracle. His only response every time he was asked is, why should I do a miracle? The prophets that have come before, they did miracles and you killed them. I am nothing more than a messenger. Not much of a defense, is it? All he needed to do was one miracle. He couldn't even do that. Yet Jesus was doing it as a baby. Proving already, now I've got 1, 2, 3, I've already got 6 areas where Jesus is superior just looking at the Quran. And then we want to end with the number 7. Oh, I love that number 7. Chapter 19, verse 19. So we start from chapter 19, verse 20. We went to chapter 3, verse 46. We went to chapter 3, verse 49. Now we end with chapter 19, verse 19. In chapter 19, verse 19, Gabriel comes to Mary and says, I'm going to give you a righteous son. Righteous means sinless, correct? Jesus is the sinless one. So say, is there anybody else in the history of mankind that was sinless? And they'll say, well, yes, the prophets were sinless. I say, look at the Quran and see all the sins every prophet did. They said, well, Muhammad was sinless. I said, then chapter 48, verse 1 and 2. Go to chapter 48 and verse 1 and 2, because it's very clear. God is saying to Muhammad, "For you must ask forgiveness for the sins you have done and the sins you are going to continue to do. Even as a prophet, he continued to sin." So certainly Muhammad sinned, but not Jesus. Chapter 19, verse 19. There it is. So I showed four verses, seven different areas where Jesus is superior to Muhammad. And look at every one of those comparisons. In every case, Muhammad is nowhere like Jesus. And I've not even gone to the Bible yet. Just starting with the Quran. Use that as a bridge to show them that you can see that Jesus is superior. And if he's superior, he's doing things that only God can do. Only God can resuscitate the dead. Only God can create out of nothing with his word. Only God is able to do this. Muhammad was incapable of doing any of this. Come on home. We got the bigger God, the better God, and also the better prophet. Theological blockages. We've already talked about, and these are theological gaps between Islam and Christianity that are sometimes unfathomable, but yet you've got to get past them. One of the biggest ones is the one I talked about earlier this morning about Yahweh versus Allah. Please, please, please don't confuse our two gods. Allah is nothing like Yahweh. Allah is incapable of doing what Yahweh can do. Not only can Yahweh come to earth, walk and talk in the cool of the day, Yahweh was doing that with Jacob. He was wrestling with Jacob. If you're wrestling, you better have a pair of legs and you better have a pair of arms. So my God can take on human form anytime he wants. One of the great things about it, though, is that you can use certain bridges to help them out. When you get to the story of Moses, because in Moses, there's another theophany. Every time that God comes to earth, that's a theophany, right? Now, most people think that theophanies are always human form. No, he is not human form. God can take on any form he wants. We got a pretty big God. Take a look at when he was leading the children of Israel through the desert. He was a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire during the night. See, my God can become a cloud during the day and a pillar of fire during the night. That's what kind of God I have. Then you want to go to the burning bush, because the burning bush is both in the Quran and in the Bible. It's in the Quran in chapter 20 and chapter 27. So it's in two places, chapter 20 and in chapter 27. I like to use the one in chapter 20, verses 10, 11, and 12. Take your Quran with you and open it up, because the Muslim won't have the Quran, as I said earlier. So open up to chapter 20, verse 10, where you see that Moses sees a fire in the distance. He goes to the fire so they can bring the firebrand back and so they can have a fire at home. As he approaches the bush that the fire is burning inside and never consuming, the voice within the bush says, "Moses, take off your shoes. You're on holy ground." Now, the question you need to ask your Muslim is, can there be holy ground without God? What's the answer? Absolutely not. Holy, by definition, means God has to be there. So is God in that bush? You'll see the gears start to tear in their mind. They won't answer right away. You can see the gears are going through, and they're saying, ooh, we're in a problem here. This is a dilemma. It is a dilemma. So then go to verse 12, because verse 12 then says that the voice within the bush says, "Truly, I am Allah who is speaking to you." Therefore, he's claiming the name of God. Can anybody take the name of God unless he's God himself? Absolutely not. So then ask your Muslim friends, okay, according to chapter 20, verse 10 to 12, is Allah in that bush? Now, depending on what they say, they're in a trouble both ways. If they say, no, he's not in that bush, this is nothing more than, I say, well, hold on a minute, that's holy ground. How can there be holy ground then if Allah's not there? How can he claim to be God if that's not God? You can't have it both ways. If they say, yes, that is God, that God is in that bush, then either they're going to have to tear that out of the Quran so that story is not there, or they're going to have to accept that in 1400 BC, God did enter time and space. In 1400 BC, he did come to earth. In 1400 BC, he was in the presence of Moses. If he could do it in 1400 BC, he could do it 2,000 years ago, and he could certainly live for 33 years on earth. You cannot have it both ways, and that's why you can use that story in chapter 2 as a bridge to help Muslims realize that even in their Quran, at one time, God did come to earth. Now, they cannot have it both ways. They cannot say God is incapable of coming to earth if he did so in chapter 20. Unless, of course, as I say to my Muslim friends, you see what happens. Be careful of the stories you borrow. Because if you borrow our stories, you're going to have to take the theology that goes with it. And that's why I love my Bible, because it's impregnated with theology. Every story is impregnated with another view of God that I want to share with them. The nature of Christ, Yeshua versus Issa. I am careful anymore to use the word Issa. I don't like the word Issa because Issa is not Arabic. Did you know that? They've got the wrong name. Issa actually comes from Syriac. And what has happened is when you look at the stories of Issa in the Quran, you will find they're not the same stories that we have in our Bible. I don't see anywhere in our Bible that Jesus created birds out of nothing and blew on them and they flew up in the air. Did you? I don't see in my Bible where Jesus spoke from the cradle. Did you? I don't see anywhere in chapter 19, it says that when his mother gets hungry, he orders a palm tree to bow down and give the fruit to his mother, helping his mother to eat. I don't know anywhere where little baby Jesus taught his mother how to eat. Not in my Bible. So where do these stories come from? If you look at all these stories, you will see they all come from the same source. They come from the lost books of the Bible, the lost books of the Bible in Arabic, but they are not written in Arabic. They are all written in Syriac. They are Gnostic writings. None of them were considered to be authoritative. They were all written after the 2nd century AD. They go from the 2nd century up into the 5th century AD. They were written by the sectarian Gnostics. The church had always rejected them because of the fact that they do not agree with the original text. They were written long after the New Testament had already been canonized, and that's why they were never incorporated. And they went with the Jews, I'm sorry, they went with these Christians, many of whom were sectarian, who were then thrown out of the Byzantine Empire. Most of them went down into Arabia, and they took these stories with them. That's why those who wrote the Quran had access to these stories. As they put these stories into the Quran in chapter 19, in chapter 3, those two chapters specifically, these stories obviously were in conflict with the biblical account. That's why the Christians never accepted the Quran. They could see that these were the wrong stories. But more so, when they incorporated the stories, they also took the name with it. Because the name of Jesus in Syriac is Iesu. When you take Iesu and put it into Arabic, it becomes Issa. Now, knowing that, we then have done some historical research, and we've found that the earliest translation of the New Testament into Arabic comes from a document called the Sinaitic Codex 151, which is found in St. Catherine's Monastery there in the Sinai Peninsula, the same place the Sinaiticus was found in the 1800s. This was just found about 20 years ago. When they opened it up and looked at it, they found that this was the first translation of the New Testament into Arabic, and it was dated to 868. That's the late 9th century. Muhammad died in 632. The Quran supposedly was canonized in 652. We're going to destroy that this afternoon, but nonetheless. 868. That's the late 9th century. And look at the name for Jesus in the Arabic Bible. Yeshua. Yeshua. So where does Issa come from? Issa is a Syriac Jesus, is a sectarian Jesus, a Gnostic Jesus, a heretical Jesus. No wonder we don't accept him. That's why I won't accept Issa for my Jesus anymore. I only go with Yeshua. The true name for Jesus in Arabic should be Yeshua. But use this as a bridge because you can see then how they need to hear. Now, the nature of man, I won't get into that. Revelation, man's fault. There's so much here, but that'll take me. I can see I only have 12. I haven't even gone into the bridges yet. So let me continue on. Let's go to some of the missiological blockages. Missiologically speaking, we have done some problems. There have been some real problems in the missiological field, especially with the Islamic world. One of the big problems we've always had, and it's not just the Islamic world, we've had this in the Hindu world as well, in India. When we go into missions, we tend to, in the old days, especially the colonial area, we always started hospitals, schools, and orphanages. And the problem with hospitals, schools, and orphanages, they cost a lot of money. They need an awful lot of finance to keep them going. And what tends to happen is, especially in places like India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, many of the people who then were then incorporated and then taught and actually did the education so that they could run those hospitals and those schools were Indians who then were converted. And many of them who were converted, immediately they turned around and made sure their aunts, uncles, cousins, and brothers got all the jobs. And that started what we call a Rice Christian. That's where the term Rice Christian came from in the 1950s by Donald McGavran here at Fuller Seminary. He coined the term because looking at the problem of the church in India. The problem is that is what we call the social gospel. The social gospel, by definition, creates the wrong kinds of Christians because it creates Christians that only see the gospel as being something that's financial and gives you a financial gain. And therefore, they don't want evangelism because they don't want to use evangelism because if other people are converted, they can then share in the pie that's meant and supposed to be kept for your family and relatives. So the social gospel has been a real deterrent to evangelism after the first generation. The other problem is what we know as contextualization. And I've talked about that, but I think this is where the problem is. In Islamic work, we've always had five problems. The five major problems are, first of all, we get very few converts. And once you get a convert, immediately they get persecuted. And once they get persecuted, they need to be extracted from the community to keep from the persecution. Am I correct? Who extracts them? We have to extract them. In order to extract them, that means they become a parasite on us. They become dependent on us. So parasitism sets in, which costs an awful lot of money. How do you solve those five problems? Conversion that creates persecution, that creates extraction, that causes parasitism, that creates an awful lot of dependency, financial dependency. How do you solve all five of those problems? Well, being American, you've come up with an answer. There's a very simple answer, and that is don't let them leave Islam. Let them remain in Islam. Let them stay inside. If they stay and remain Muslims, continue to call themselves Muslims, continue to go to the mosque regularly, continue to believe that Allah and Yahweh are the same God, so that Allah is your God. Continue and understand Muhammad is in the prophetic line. Also, do the five prayers. Continue to do the Hajj if need be. For all practical reasons, stay a Muslim. Don't become a Christian. We don't need any more Christians. We need more Muslims that love Jesus as Lord and Savior. How do you feel about that? No one's going to support it? This is the ethos of what we now call the insider movement, which comes from America. This is invented by you all, right here down the road. It's now being taught at Fuller Seminary. That's my alma mater. That's where I got my master's. And I was there in the 1980s learning about this. I heard about it. We didn't call it insider movement. We called it contextualization. And I thought it was brilliant because I like contextualization. That's bridging, is it not? The problem is, contextualization is fine as long as you only contextualize culturally. Once you start contextualizing theologically, you've gone too far. And that's the difficulty I have with that. And that's where this bridge, which we thought was a bridge, is actually becoming a blockage. Because we're finding that people that remain in Islam, we lose them. We don't know where they are. We can claim as many numbers, and we are claiming millions of converts. But where are they? Are they in your churches? Are you going to have contact with them? Are they going to be in the family of God? Are they coming to your conferences? They cannot, because as soon as they do, you expose them, and then, of course, the persecution begins. So the whole need not to create persecution, not to have extraction, creates an elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about, because by doing that, what you're saying is we must keep them at arm's length and not let them be part of the church. And if you leave them part of the church, if you don't have them part of the church, then how in the world are they going to be protected? Where is the church to protect them? Why do you think Christ created the church? Because that's the best way to protect those who are persecuted. And he said very clearly that your biological family is not your major family. Remember, very clearly, when his mother were there outside the room, and he was told by the disciples told him, that your mother is outside. He said, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? You are my brothers. You are my... He redefined the family. It is not your biological family. It is the church. We are the new family. And that's why the church has survived for 2,000 years. We have survived because of extraction. We have survived because of persecution. If you have any doubt, read the book of Acts. It is full of persecution. Folks, if you want to find out what Christ thinks about it, just read Matthew 10. Look at the commissioning of the 12. He says very clearly, as he commissions the 12 disciples, I'm sending you out as lamb before wolves. You're going to be hated for my name. You're going to be persecuted for my name. You're going to be jailed for my name. You're going to be flogged for my name. You're going to be killed for my name. Did he not say that? Is that not the commissioning? How many of you who have been commissioned in your church have been commissioned like that? I'm ordained. I was never commissioned like that. But I think we all should be commissioned like that, because then he goes on and says in verse 34 of chapter 10, I have not come to bring peace, I have come to bring the sword, to set father against son and mother against daughter. Basically, he's saying the people that are going to do the persecution are your own family. It's your family that's going to persecute you. So why are we trying to keep them in the family? When Christ was very clear that they're the worst, they're the ones that are going to do the most damage. And that's why when you look at the Muslim family, take a look at the Muslim family. In almost every case, those who have converted to Christianity, it's been their family who've done the most persecuting. Am I not correct? I think Christ knew exactly what he was talking about. And that's when I talked to MBBs, Muslim from a background, MBBs, Muslim background believers. They don't like to use the word MBBs. Most of the ones I come across, they all like CMBs, Christian from a Muslim background. They like to put Christ's name first. Bless them. When I look at them and I ask them about the insider movements, almost the biggest criticism I get are from other Muslim believers. Sorry, Christian believers from a Muslim background. We need to be careful about missiological blockers. We need to be careful that we don't try to implicate. We don't. If we don't follow the biblical model, then I don't think that we're going to... There's no reason in the world that we should get into missions. We've got to make sure that we do what Christ demanded of us. He says in verse 38 of chapter 10, "For he who is not willing to bear my cross is not worthy to be my disciple." Be careful what you do to your Muslim background believers. They will understand it much more than you do. I mean, you told me, a sister over here afterwards, she says, "I don't even like to read the Quran." That's right. You don't like to read the Quran because you feel almost like there's an oppression there. I have my Muslims, I like to go to the mosques and I like to get into debates in mosques all the time. I get barred from mosques now because of the fact that I'm too high profile. But I want to take my Muslim background believers with me, and they stop about 100 yards away and said, "We're not going any further." I said, "Why not?" She says, "Well, don't you feel the evil spirits?" I don't feel them. But my MBB friends feel them. They can see the oppression. You can feel the oppression when you read the Quran. We need our MBB people to help us to realize what we're up against, because this is a battle of spiritual battle that we're not even aware of, because as Americans, we're inane to spiritual battles. We do not feel evil spirits, not like our Muslim background believers do. I go to mosque after mosque, and I don't feel a thing. But my Muslim background believer feels an enormous amount of oppression, and I need to listen to them. This is a blockage that we have that we have to be careful with. Let's continue on. Another blockage that we're getting is this eisegeting and exegeting the Quran. I'm going to get into that in the next section. Let's hold off on that. Before we do that, I want to talk about friendship first and peace at any cost. I'm a Brethren in Christ missionary, and that means I come from the Mennonite tradition. And in the Mennonite tradition, this is almost our mantra, that the gospel is the gospel of peace and tolerance. Peace and reconciliation is the name that we always talk. And I've always scratched my head on that. And I've always said, where in the Bible does it say that the gospel is the gospel of peace and reconciliation? We are to be people of peace and reconciliation, but the gospel is not a peace and reconciliation. The gospel is absolutely provocative. The gospel is as combative. The gospel is controversial as you can get. If it wasn't so, then what in the world do we see when we open the book of Acts and we see persecution after persecution? Everybody was persecuted for the first 300 years until Constantine made Christianity the international religion. The whole church was full of persecution. Why? Because they preached the gospel. When you preach the gospel to a Muslim, you're going to be persecuted. There is confrontation. Anytime you say that God enters time and space, that confronts a Muslim. Anytime you say that God died on the cross and rose again, you're going to confront a Muslim. Anytime you say that God has a son, you're going to confront a Muslim. Yet you have to say that. That's the gospel. And if you're not going to say that, then you're wasting your time. At some point, you're going to have to introduce the gospel into every conversation. The sooner you get to it, the better you are, because Muslims can handle it. They're good at it, and they will confront you with it. Expect it, and know that you're doing the same thing Paul did every time he went into the synagogues. He got confronted for preaching the gospel. All the disciples, everyone that was commissioned, when Christ commissioned them, take a look at every one of them. Every one of the disciples was hated, were they not, for the gospel. They were all persecuted, were they not. They were all put in prison. Every one of them was flogged. All of them were killed except for John. John was the only one that wasn't killed. They were all killed except for him. They received their commissioning. We need to be commissioned like that. This idea that somehow there's going to be peace and reconciliation whenever you preach the gospel, that's not the gospel, folks. The gospel is absolutely confrontational, especially to Muslims. Friendship first. I've never always asked my people that start with friendship first, where in the Bible does it talk about friendship first? Did any of the disciples become friends before they preached the gospel? Did Jesus ever make friendships first? Did Paul ever go and shake people's hands before he preached the gospel? Did he ever go and invite himself into the synagogues? No, he never invited himself once. He just walked right in. Like my friend Hatun Tosh, she just walks into the mosques. She walks uninvited. She never invites, gets friends first. And she confronts them with their Quran. And she gets thrown out. Every week she gets thrown out. She goes into 4 mosques a week. She's been in 400 now. What a woman. She's just following what Paul does. But we need people like that again. We need to get back to that paradigm. We need to get back to that example. Friendship first. Here's the problem. If you create friends first, should we ever be creating friends if we have an agenda attached to that friendship? Are we making friends to convert them? If that is so, is that true friendship? And what will the Muslims say when they find out that the only reason you made a friend with them is because you wanted to convert them? That's deceitful, isn't it? Would you want a Muslim to do that to you? Absolutely not. I go into a bookstore in London, and Ahmed is the guy in charge. And as soon as I walk in, he puts everything down. He puts his arm around me, and he says to everybody there, "This man, he will become a Muslim before he leaves today." God bless him. So I turn and said, no, this man's going to become a Christian before I leave today. I'm up and I'm out front. And so is he. He is as honest as you can get. Absolutely. Our relationship is built on the need to convert the other. We are open about it. And the only ones I can do that with are Muslims. Because every Muslim I know wants to convert me. And they tell it to my face. So why aren't we just as passionate and why aren't we just as honest as them? We are so scared to tell them what our agenda is because we don't want to lose that friendship. But that's not true friendship. True friendship should be as honest as you can be. Be right up front with your friends and folks. You're living in America. You're not going to be thrown out of America because the Muslims don't like what you're doing. This is your country. Remember, they're your guests. So be a little bit more proactive and start learning from them. God bless the ones we saw yesterday. I'm new to America, so I'm still getting to know about your Muslims here. They're not nearly as radical as the one we have in Britain. So I have to be careful because almost all my anecdotes are from Britain. And the British ones, they're so in your face, and they're so aggressive. But I don't call it aggression. I love their passion. I love their passion. Sheikh Umar Bakri Muhammad, the most radical Muslim in Britain, when he first got to know me, I used to dog him because every college campus he went into, he caused such a furore because the Islamic societies were only about 20 or 30 when he came in. They went to 200 to 300. They had to open big rooms like this and big assembly rooms to accommodate him. And this guy was from Syria, but he had fled to Britain because he tried to overthrow the government in Syria. And so coming to Britain, of course, Britain being the way it is, it just gave him a car, it gave him a school, it gave him a house, it took care of all his medical attention. He's living high on the hog. He's became the Ayatollah of Tottenham. And so I would go, and he became good friends, and we had 4 debates that we did. But he wanted me to come to his school to talk to his students. And so he introduced me this way. He says, "This is my favorite Christian. But this will be the first man I kill when Islam comes to Britain." What an introduction. And I had no problem with that introduction because he was being absolutely honest. I would be the first one he killed. He would have to kill me because of what I represent. And I just turned to him and says, "I'll never kill you." See the difference? You're not a threat to me. Because I have Jesus Christ. You can kill me all you want, but you won't kill him. And because of that honesty, I think we need to learn from that honesty. There's something that the Muslims have that we need to learn. They have a passion we don't have. They have an honesty that I'm jealous of. And we need to start being just as honest as them. Just as transparent as they are. And you will find that you will make friends left, right, and center. When I'm at Speaker's Corner, and I go up to people, well, it's usually a guy, not a girl, but I say, "Give me your hand. I love you. God bless you." They won't shake my hand. They won't touch me because I'm Shaitan. I'm Satan. No, we're not going to touch you. You're Satan. And they put an evil grimace on their face. And I say, "Well, I love you. My Lord Jesus Christ loves you. Even though I do not agree with you, I absolutely love you. Let me hug you." And they won't never let me touch you. Now, when we get to KFC after the corner, the same guys will come and give me back rubs. What's going on here? in the public face. This is the public face of Islam, and you'll see it often. The public face will be, especially in battle, like we are at Speaker's Corner, they will not even let me touch their hand because I corrupt them. But when I'm in Speaker's at KFC, away from the battle, we're best friends. And this is something you've got to realize. They will raise their voice. They will get angry at you. They will call you all kinds of names. You'll get death threats. They will not kill you. And the more passionate you are, the better friends you become. The more they'll want to spend time with you, and the more open they will be to the gospel. We're getting hundreds of Muslims that are coming home to Jesus Christ because we are acting just like them. So true contextualization is not just saying the right thing, it's also walking the walk and talking the talk. Walk like they do, talk like they do. Don't just wear the same clothes they wear. Make sure that you be as passionate as they are. The bridges. I only have 2-3 minutes to go. Let me finish with the bridges. There, one bridge that we use in Britain is called dialogues. I will do dialogues, but I always will make sure that I prepare for debate. If you go into a dialogue with a Muslim, prepare for a debate. The reason why is dialogues are really a Western invention. They are not understood by Muslims. They don't understand the premise. The whole premise behind dialogues is you start on this side. The Christian always goes first, whatever the subject is, and they only say what Christianity believes on that subject. Then the Muslim goes second, and they're supposed to say only what they believe on Islam. But invariably, in every dialogue I have been, as soon as the Christian has given their premise, the Muslim then comes and attacks it. And the Christian's not prepared for that kind of attack. And they go after attack after attack, and after 2 hours, the Christian is bumbling, they're looking hopeless, they're looking stupid, they are getting tongue-tied, they have not been prepared for this kind of battle. And after 2 hours, everybody then leaves the dialogue thinking that Christianity has all the problems. Not one thing has been said about Islam. No one has asked the same questions of Islam, because none of us are prepared to do so. Because we assume that dialogues are understood by Muslims. God bless them, they don't understand dialogues at all, because dialogues are politically correct. They are not politically correct. And that's why be prepared for a debate. But more than that, if you're going to go into a dialogue with a Muslim, make sure that you take the same questions they throw at you and apply it right back in their laps. Put it right back. Remember, the best defense is a good offense. Vince Lombardi said that, right? That's one of your footballing terms. The best defense is a good offense. Always be on the offense. And then we're going to end off with some of the biblical uses of the Quran. I've gone through a number of them. They call it the camel method. I like the camel method if it's used correctly. Do not use eisegesis. Please do not misinterpret the Quran. We get upset if they do that with our Bible. Don't do that to the Quran. So when you look at the crucifixion that David said this morning, this afternoon, chapter 4, verse 157, I've heard many missionaries and many Christians say that that's not really talking, that really is accepting the crucifixion. I don't know of any Muslim that would agree with that. And the reason they get around that, they say when you read it correctly, it says, "For they killed him not." Who is they? They means the Jews. And it's true, the Jews didn't kill him, it was the Romans that killed him. So therefore, Jesus, according to the Quran, Jesus was crucified. Folks, I don't know of any Muslim that would accept that interpretation. And that's playing with interpretation, and that's not honest. That's not honest. That's deceitful. Don't do that with the Quran, because you don't want them to do that with the Bible. I've told you already that you can use the Quran. You can use it with the fall of man. Did we go into this one, the fall of man? They confront us all the time with the fact that we are imputed with Adam and Eve's guilt. So they do not like original sin, because how could Adam and Eve's sin be imputed on us? That has nothing to do with us. That is unjust. In fact, this just came up yesterday. One of the guys that I was talking to, he was in his car. We were having engaging a conversation. And he said, the biggest problem, I said, what is your problem with Christianity? What's your problem with Jesus Christ? And he says, how can we be guilty for Adam and Eve's sin? And then he says in chapter 6, verse 164, in chapter 53, verse 38 of the Quran, it's very clear that nobody can take on the guilt of another. That's very clear in the Quran. I said, okay, so you have a problem with imputed sin. You have a problem with original sin in chapter 3. Of the New Test of Genesis. I said, you have a problem with Genesis and also with the crucifixion. I said, well, then let me just ask you to go in the Quran, which he didn't have. No one of them have Qurans. Chapter 7, verse 24. Go in the Quran and look and see your Garden of Eden. Your Garden of Eden is not on earth. It's up in space, is it not? He said, yeah, that's true. I said, well, what happened in verse 24 of chapter 7? Adam and Eve are thrown out of the garden down to earth, are they not? They're thrown out of the garden and they're down to earth. Now, let me ask you, and I forget what his name is. His name was Muhammad. I said, Muhammad, are you up in that garden right now? Are any of you up in that garden? Is this the garden? Diamond bar? Is this the Garden of Eden up in space? No, it isn't. I said, the fact that all of us are on earth means all of us are imputed with Adam and Eve's sin, according to your Quran. How do you deal with that? They have never dealt with it. In 35, 37 years of asking Muslims this question, I have yet to see a Muslim that has ever answered that question. So they have imputed, they've borrowed that story from the Bible, and they've misunderstood enormously. How is it that we are imputed with that sin? Use that, chapter 7, verse 24. The burning bush that I talked about, chapter 20, verse 10 to 14. The virgin birth that I talked about in chapter 19, verse 20, use that as a bridge. 19, verse 19, the righteous one, use that as a bridge. Jesus greater than Muhammad, I gave you the references in chapter 19, verse 20, chapter 3, verse 46, chapter 3, verse 49, and end with chapter 19, verse 19. Use that as a bridge. And then, of course, the birth, death, and resurrection. I can see that George is coming here. I've got to shut up and sit down. If any of you do want to have any more of these registrations, come and get them from me. If you want our prayer card, come and get them from me. And if you want to sign up on either our prayer list or on the Founder Sent course, they're right over here on my right. God bless you. It's been great having this time with you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you so much.